You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again one of our more frequent guests, Alistair McLeod. Alistair, as you know by now, most of you, is a senior fellow at the Gold Money Foundation, and he's the head of research there. His weekly articles can be accessed from Gold Money, and I would highly recommend that you go there to read them. In fact, it's usually after I've read one or two of his articles that I feel compelled to give him a call and see if we can coax him into coming on the show. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's my pleasure, Jay.
Oh, it's always always so good to hear from you. I really want to talk to you today about an October 11th article that you wrote, "The Credit Cycle is on the Turn." Now, we've talked to you about the credit cycle before. You've gone through the anatomy of the credit cycle and pretty well convinced us that when we were going from the third phase to the fourth phase, that we were nearing that phase now. And from this article, I gather you think that we are there. We're certainly starting the fourth cycle, I believe. But you lead the article of October 11th with the following comment. You say, "We are on the verge of moving into an era of high interest rates, so markets will behave differently from any time since the early 1980s. There are enough similarities with the post-Bretton Woods era of the 1970s to give us some guidance as to how markets are likely to evolve in the foreseeable future." End of quote. Now, I believe that we have had, if memory serves me correctly, three business, or let's say credit cycles. I'm going to call them credit cycles rather than business cycles. Since 1980, that's 1990, 2000, 2008. Those are the ones that I recall anyway. With each cycle, we have emerged with lower interest rates, lower lows, lower highs, each cycle. That's what's been taking place. But am I to understand from your lead-in comments in that article that you are suggesting with the next cycle, we are now likely to see, we are not likely to see new interest rate lows in the next cycle? You think we're going to start, the secular bull market in bonds is over, and we're heading into a bear market in bonds, a secular bear market perhaps?
Yes, I think that's right, Jay. The reasons, really, I mean, the reasons I sort of drew the parallel with the late 60s, early 70s was that that was the time when the gold pool failed in London. And what was really behind it was America had printed an awful lot of dollars for export. I mean, you Americans didn't dip into your pockets and pay extra taxes to pay for the Vietnam War,
for example. That's right.
Or the Korean War, for that matter. Governments don't pay for wars by taxing people because they would never get the mandate to go to war. So what do? They print the money. The money goes abroad. And in this case, I mean, we're talking about cash, real cash. And of course, it was the old French Indochina was Vietnam. So France, through all its old connections, ended up with an awful lot of dollars. And it was France that decided, well, we don't want all these dollars. If you remember de Gaulle and Jacques Rueff, his economic advisor, yes, were basically running the show at that stage. And they decided that what they wanted is they wanted gold under the Bretton Woods agreement. So they went for gold and dumped dollars. And the result was there was a run on central bank dollars, and particularly the U.S. Treasuries, sorry, not dollars, the U.S. Treasuries gold. There was, right, a run on that. When that initially happened, we set up the London Gold Pool, which is basically other central banks coming in to try and, you know, suppress the price at $35. That failed. And then we had a few sort of moments of trying to increase it. And they got it up to $42.22. And it was at that point in 1971 when Nixon turned around and said, "We are suspending the Bretton Woods Agreement." we are no longer going to supply gold in return for dollars. It was a temporary arrangement, and here we are all that time later in this temporary arrangement. But the lesson behind it was a surplus of dollars in foreign hands. Now, at the moment, and this is a fascinating thing, everybody's talking about the foreigners not having enough dollars. But actually, when you look at the underlying numbers, that's not true. The foreigners have been financing the U.S. budget deficit for a considerable time. And the result is that they have got, you know, between U.S. treasuries and equity investments in America and all the rest of it, they've got dollar investments, which total, including cash, $22 trillion. Dollars. Now, that was at the last record, date of record, which was June 2017. Mm-hmm. I guess it's gone up since then because markets have risen, one. Yeah. And secondly, the trade deficit from America has, continued and got worse. So you can see that the requirement for foreigners to recycle dollars, which they've earned from surplus exports into U.S. treasuries and similar things, has continued. So we don't know what the number is, but it is enormous. And the last figure we had, that June 17 figure, also included over $4 trillion of cash. And this is cash held in correspondent bank accounts. Mm-hmm. So this is cash that exists, if you like, on the balance sheets of the big banks in New York, the New York money center banks. It also exists, if you like, on the bank accounts, the dollar bank accounts of Deutsche Bank, of BNP, Banque Nationale de Paris, and all the rest of them, all around the world. So you can see that foreigners own an awful lot of dollars. And just to remind you, the $22 trillion is more than US GDP. So the idea that there's a dollar scarcity is in foreign hands is not true. What people are conflating is the fact that some foreign governments and a lot of emerging markets have borrowed in dollars and have liabilities to pay back in dollars in due course. But that's not an immediate issue. That is an issue which is going to be rolled over or maybe lead to a crisis in an individual country from time to time. And we've seen that the countries which have placed themselves in this mm-hmm. weak position, you know, their currencies have been undermined and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. That is just normal business, if you like, in this context. It's not evidence that the whole world is short of dollars. No, it is not. So we have a situation actually where instead of being short of dollars, we are long of dollars in exactly the same way as we were in the late 1960s. All us foreigners have got too many dollars. And guess what's happening this time? This time, America is becoming introspective. She's turning around saying, we do not want to have trade deficits with the Chinese and the EU and Korea and so on and mm-hmm. so forth. So what we're going to do is we're going to introduce tariffs. In other words, America is becoming introspective. She's going back into herself. Mm-hmm. This is going to have an effect on foreign demand for dollars in the future. And as well as that, there's another subject which you and I have discussed from time mm-hmm. to time, and that is that China is trying to replace her cross-border trade with yuan rather than using dollars. And her cross-border trade is now really very enormous in a global context because she's just about sewn up the whole of Africa. She's the largest trading partner for Australia. She does an awful lot of trade with Japan, Korea, and places, countries like Chile and in Latin America and so on and so forth. I mean, she is absolutely enormous. So what I can see is that things are sort of really potentially turning rather nasty for the dollar. And now we look at what's happening to the yields on the Treasury market. And in the article which you referred to, I showed a chart of the 10-year Treasury yield. And anyone who's sort of got an elementary grasp of technical analysis would look at that chart and say, good grief, that yield is going to go through the roof. you've got the moving averages, but the ones which are commonly used, they're in bullish sequence with a price above them, looking like it's just broken out of a previous high. And where's it going to end? So you can see that there are a number of factors coming together to suggest there is a huge turn, if you like, in the whole interest rate cycle. Mm-hmm. I can then go on from there and say, what this is, what happens under these circumstances is you get a change of attitude amongst investors. At the moment, everybody believes what the government tells them about inflation. Inflation is at 3%. No, it's not. Inflation is closer to 10%. If you look at a fixed basket of goods, it's around about 10%.
John Williams' work.
Yeah. John Williams and Chapwood as well. That's the other one. They do a sort of a catch up every 6 months. But the reason this is important is, let us assume that you are a business and you are in the business of manufacturing, and you're thinking, I think we ought to invest in making a new product if we can do it profitably. And what you will do is you will look at what's on the market at the moment, and you will look at the prices today, and you say, right, I think that if we can sell our new product and undercut that by a few cents, I think we're on a winner. We should be able to shift some good volumes. So you start planning for this. You borrow the money. You assume that where interest rates are, that your money cost is not going to be all that great. You know what it is. You maybe build in a little bit of margin and so on and so forth. You know what the costs of the goods that you need to buy in to make your product are. And if you're terribly clever and you sort of think, well, you know, and we're told the rate of inflation is 3%, so, you know, we might just add on 3%. Right. But then you find that actually, because you're not buying your, you know, the bits that you put together out of a moving basket, which, you know, sort of constantly changes to lower the rate of inflation, you're actually buying the fixed basket. You're buying the things that are going up 10%, not a basket that's going up 3%. And you then think, hold on a minute, this is not quite what we originally thought. You can see how suddenly this idea that, you know, the CPI says it's 3% and we accept it, that can very, very rapidly change into an understanding that actually that's not true. And then it's not very far from there when you see the US government getting into funding difficulties, which is almost certain because of what they're trying to do. You then begin to think about the rate of inflation, and you begin to think, well, you know, this is not good news. It's going higher, and it is quite possible that the person in the real world, faced with buying a fixed basket of goods, finds that instead of it being 10%, as John Williams and Chapwood say, you're then looking at something maybe in the teens. And that then becomes very, very dangerous. And I think that's the sort of cyclical dynamics that we face over the next few years.
So, your thesis really has to do with the dollar, the strength of the dollar, and the integrity of the dollar, if you will. And I've long wondered, how can we continue to get away with these massive deficits? And I've wondered this long before we were running $1 trillion-a-year deficits. When we were running $100 billion-a-year deficits, I wondered, it seemed crazy. How could this be? And now we're seeing these enormous deficits, and I have to wonder, how are these treasuries going to be paid for? And you're talking about now, if I'm hearing what you're saying, foreigners have plenty of dollars, but they have them locked up, a lot of them in treasuries. Now, if they have to start selling treasuries to finance their own growth or their own needs, Japan, for example, I think might be in that condition, with Japan having, Japan having the demographics issues even more than we have in the West.
Yeah,
are they having to sell their treasuries just to make ends meet domestically, and how do you see this?
The Japanese are, I think, a slightly special case because their corporations do most of their manufacturing abroad, so they're funding in different currencies and all the rest of it. I think probably. The best country to look at is China, because China is the largest holder of U.S. treasuries. She's got just over $1 trillion of them, and she's also got another $2 trillion of reserves, most of which are cash dollars or dollars on deposit or whatever. That's part of that $4 trillion of cash that I was talking about. So where is she in this? I mean, she's in the position where America's being pretty unfriendly, to say the least. Yeah. And she has got her own plans, and she's got to move on. She can't hang around. I mean, she's got infrastructure development in China itself. She's building new cities. I mean, the pace of technological innovation in China is truly staggering. I mean, it's exponential. And then she wants to go on and repeat the same trick throughout the Asian continent. I mean, we're talking roughly just under half the world's population being tied up in this massive mega machine, which mm-hmm. America has no part in. Mm-hmm. And China is running the show, and she's got too many dollars. So I can't see really that the foreigners in aggregate are going to continue to support the budget deficits of the United States by sort of recycling their dollars. I think, if anything, they're likely to be sellers on the margin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I think there is a funding crisis in the making, and this is why I have made a comparison with that situation in the 60s, which led to the failure of the gold pool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just see exactly the same dynamics. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, in the 70s, we had oil crises after oil crises. But what do we have today? We have an oil price that's already doubled. And who is the largest exporter of energy? Russia. Are they friendly? You've got Iran. Are they friendly? At the moment, we don't have too much of a problem because America is exporting shale oil and also consuming shale oil. That's been remarkably successful. But the problem with shale is that a shale well has a very, very limited lifetime.
That's
right. And so, you've got to continue to develop new ones. And of course, the nature of things, what's happened is that you go for the best prospects and you sort of leave the not so good ones for later on. So the idea that this output can be maintained by America, mm-hmm. I think, is being very optimistic, over-optimistic.
I think so. And you didn't even mention Saudi Arabia and the big question mark there right now in terms of the relationships with the United States. And I see Mr. Putin didn't waste too much time in saying, well, we're here if you need us. It wasn't true during the Obama years that the Saudis were talking to China about selling oil to China, and that was during the time when Mr. Obama had turned towards the Iranians with the Iranian nuclear deal and so on and so forth. So, there's a lot of different things, a lot of moving parts. But you mentioned the infrastructure that China has. I think it was just today that I heard they had just opened up a bridge, a 34-mile bridge between Macau and Hong Kong. And I think one of the things we never focus on much in America is what's really going on with the one road, one bridge initiative that's going on, too. The massive infrastructure that China is putting in place to trade with some of the other countries that are not necessarily all that friendly to the United States, Russia being one of them.
Yeah.
So this new petrol yuan thing that we talked about, I see there's many things, and really your idea about inflation, I mean, I think that the real key is being able to see the potential dollar weakness. So, for example, you bring this issue up with many people, they'll say, yeah, but there's nobody else that has a currency with enough liquidity to become the world's reserve currency. How do you answer that criticism?
Well, I think it's an interesting one. The short answer is that people who are looking at things that way are running their forecasts on a linear basis. Actually, what's happening is exponential in China. I think mm-hmm. that's the first thing. Things are happening a lot more quickly than you would think. The second thing, I would admit that the recent weakness in the yuan has meant that the Chinese have had to buy in yuan, which has reduced the liquidity in international markets. So that has been a retrograde step for them. And I think that if they are going to succeed in their objectives, then what they're going to have to do is to embrace a stronger currency. because a stronger currency will basically mean that imported inflation is lessened or blunted very substantially. And this is going to be important because they are such large buyers of things like copper, nickel, cement, iron, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. All those industrial materials, they're such enormous buyers that actually there isn't the supply there for them. They are going to drive up the prices in dollar terms. Mm-hmm. The question then is, will they drive it up as much in yuan terms? Mm-hmm. And given we're talking about infrastructure, domestic infrastructure, and infrastructure around her Asian neighbors, mm-hmm. I would have thought that it makes an awful lot of sense for her to switch over to a strong currency. And particularly, if she signals a strong currency to all her trading partners, they will be a lot more likely to accept it as in payment for raw materials or whatever than they would dollars. So I think there could be a big sea change from that angle as well, which nobody is expecting.
Well, nobody's expecting. To what extent, though, do you think the capability of trading yuan for gold is important in giving the yuan credibility?
I don't think at this stage that's terribly important. I think monetary policy and interest rate, exchange rate policy, if you like, is going to be far more important in the very short term. Mm-hmm. The fact that, if you find that the yuan is going up, then as far as the ordinary citizen in Shanghai or Beijing or whatever is concerned, he will see gold as good value in his own currency. And I think that will sustain demand and probably continue to see the deliveries out of the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which are currently running at anything between 150 and 200 tons a month. I think that will be sustained, and on a strong yuan, it could even increase from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so here we see one of my guests right before you was talking about what the United States should do with this caravan of some 10,000 people now. Heading towards the American border. And Ryan Gudurski, my guest, suggested that what we should do is bring our soldiers home from Afghanistan and put them inside the Mexican border and stop these people from coming in. Well, I mean, I mentioned that now in our discussion simply because it seems to me Dwight Eisenhower was right. The military-industrial complex, you know, Alistair, I can't think of any industry that's bigger for the United States right now than the military-industrial complex. And President Trump immediately with this issue with Saudi Arabia now brought up the issue, well, we can't lose our arms sales to Saudi Arabia, to the Russians or the Chinese. Mm. So, I just wonder how this is. There's so many moving parts here. And if we're talking about a country that needs to borrow from foreigners in order to sustain our military and our economy so that we can keep grabbing their territory, keep the Chinese from having their access to their own sea lanes and things like that. I don't know, Alistair. It's a very unnerving situation, a very unnerving picture. I think you're safer there in the British Isles than I am here in New York City.
Well, you mentioned Saudi Arabia. One thing that nobody has mentioned at all is the position of Israel in this. Israel must be extremely worried. And I think that's actually more important in terms of America's geopolitical policy, and ours for that matter, than just losing $100 billion of arms sales to Saudi Arabia by... Yeah. You know, whatever. The other aspect of that, of course, is that if we stop supplying Saudi Arabia, then, as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Putin will be very happy to come in and do a deal. So, and that's something that I don't think our politicians would like to see.
No, I don't think so. Well, we'll have to leave it go at that, Alistair. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us again. I would tell people to go read what Alistair is writing at Gold Money. It's a very interesting article on Gibson's paradox that I think those of you who are really into the financial markets will find very interesting. Alistair, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look to do it again sometime, I hope, in the near future.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, folks, next week we're going to have Dr. Quentin Henning of Noble Resources with me. We're going to have one of the I've forgotten his name now. One of David McElveny's guys is going to be with us, and it's really embarrassing to me. I've forgotten his name, but he's a top analyst, and you're going to want to hear what he has to say. Michael Oliver, of course, will be with us as well. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
A gold rush has begun. Recently, three of the largest gold mining companies announced strategic acquisitions in the Yukon Territories. Ahead of them was a group who had already consolidated the key claims covering the historic Klondike Gold Rush into one company, aptly named Klondike Gold Corp. Led by a team of accomplished geoscientists, the company is steadily advancing exploration to reveal the rich source of all that gold. The hunt for the next major discovery is well underway, and Klondike Gold's shareholders are strategically positioned. Stay ahead of the majors and follow KlondikeGoldCorp.com.